Folks, please have your seats. We're about to start, and I don't want a lot of nonsense going on while the speaker's up here talking. It's only courtesy to sit and be quiet while the speaker is talking. All right, thank you. I like this.
Phil, sit.
Our next speaker is the owner of Terra Firma Records, and he's going to give a talk about the Columbia Phonograph Company in Washington, D.C. Here he is, my new paisan, Timothy Fabrizio.
Please make sure that you get one of the hastily prepared timelines that I am distributing here, because, hey, you need a scorecard or you can't enjoy the game. I'm afraid if you don't have that timeline, I might lose you. It is a pretty complex story. And then, of course, I will be speaking in Esperanto. So, sorry, that was... I know that Esperanto is something you order in a coffee bar. All right. Many who have read earlier accounts will be surprised by the real story of the events related here. It's an exciting tale of danger and intrigue. But the Graphophone is not the oleaginous villain, and Edison not the hapless hero, as collectors tend to see it. It's more a story of unrequited love and jealous retribution. And I'm almost serious when I say this. Any discussion of the Columbia Phonograph Company must also include so much information about the American Graphophone Company as to make the listener wonder which is really the subject. This is, in fact, as it should be, since they were for decades two limbs of the same body and remain allied in the parlance of today's collectors who refer to any graphophone as a Columbia. So to tell the story of Columbia, one must begin with the Graphophone Company, and to tell the story of the Graphophone Company, one must mention the inventor of the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell's genius embraced a variety of fields over the course of his life. His involvement with sound-related apparati had led him to consider ways of reproducing sound even before Edison demonstrated a practical way. His father-in-law, Gardner Green Hubbard, became the president of the Edison Speaking Phonograph Company, which had been organized to exploit the business opportunities suggested by Edison's invention. The envisioned rewards, however, proved impossible to achieve, since the tinfoil phonograph, while in essence practical, was not adaptable in its nascent state to any commercial purposes other than sideshow exhibitions. Clearly, there were opportunities here, but Edison's always peripatetic attention moved elsewhere, leaving his phonograph to stagnate without improvements, and inviting the necessary problems to be solved by others, most notably, a way to make a permanent record. Bell, of course, would have heard about all this from his wife's father, and so would turn his thoughts to improving Edison's invention. Thereby would be born, not entirely by intent, a rivalry of design that would involve decades of time, millions of dollars, the strenuous efforts of thousands of men and women, and not the least, years and years in the courts. So would begin the seed which would become the American Graphophone Company and its adjunct, the Columbia Phonograph Company. In 1880, Alexander Graham Bell received an honor known as the Volta Prize from the French government. He took the money he received and set about to create an environment wherein he could work on the problems of reproducing sound. he established the eponymously named Volta Laboratory in Washington, D.C., and enlisted the assistance of a model maker who had worked with him before, Charles Sumner Tainter. He also brought in his cousin, Chichester Bell, an expert in physics. Their articles of association were signed on October 8, 1881, but were backdated to May to cover the work they had already begun. Together, they investigated every angle of the subject. They tried transmitting sound by light rays with selenium receptors, magnetic recording, and reproduction by compressed air and jets of water. However, the greatest impact of their work was to be made when they began to experiment with the use of wax as a medium for storing sound vibrations. Because Gardner Green Hubbard's company controlled the Edison phonograph patent, any work done under his aegis could be protected. He gave the Volta associates a tinfoil machine, which had been manufactured by Bramer Brothers, with which to experiment. By filling the existing groove in the mandrel with wax, Bell and his associates developed a method of incising by the action of a cutting stylus, and thereby creating a more or less permanent record that could be replayed at will. It was this machine that was deposited with the Smithsonian Institution on October 20th, 1881. According to a well-known advertisement for the Dictaphone Company, a sealed box containing the device was opened with some ceremony in 1937. However, the publicists claim that every word recorded on the mandrel was perfectly reproduced at the time cannot be called credible. Reproduction was to have been accomplished by a jet of compressed air directed at the rotating mandrel, impossible to perform in an impromptu setting. With an understanding of this, a card had been included with a transcription of the short message. The prodigious work of the Volta Lab was intended to yield a variety of patents, and patent attorney Anthony Pollock structured them to glean the most commercial possibilities. Of the lot, the most effective was to be number 341-214, granted May 4th, 1886, for recording and reproducing sound. The Volta patents would become powerful tools for shaping the talking machine industry. Yet, at first, the Volta associates had attempted to share their work with Edison, approaching the speaking phonograph company about obtaining a license to make improved phonographs. E.H. Johnson of the Edison staff suggested that Bergman and Company, a firm which had manufactured tinfoil machines, might make some sample graphophones. Although the graphophone was demonstrated to Johnson on October 3, 1885, Edison himself balked, and no agreement could be made. Thereafter, on January 6, 1886, in Alexandria, Virginia, the Volta Graphophone Company was formed and would function as the patent holding company and sometime research lab of the graphophone interests. The instrument, however, was still too primitive to achieve consistent results, though improved to the point of recording and reproducing by use of interchangeable heads. The record was a cardboard tube covered with azoserite wax, 6 inches long by 1 5/16 inch wide. A manufacturing and distributing arm was needed, and on May 13, 1887, the American Graphophone Company was organized, which had as its principal backers men like James O. Clephane, Andrew Devine, and John H. White, who were Supreme Court or congressional reporters. They saw the potential of the device in aiding transcription, though they would fail utterly to appreciate the impact of pre-recorded music. The new company issued brochures and gave demonstrations at the 9th Annual Convention of the Business Education Association of America in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the Spencerian Business College in Washington, D.C. Elsewhere, Thomas Edison turned his attention to what was going on in the realm of sound reproduction. He vigorously objected to the graphophone interests, claiming that he had anticipated their developments in his British phonograph patent. However, that patent had been denied in the US, and the American one was not broad enough to include the areas covered by the Volta work. Fearing the loss of control over his invention, Edison began working on it with Ezra T. Gilliland. An Edison Phonograph Company was formed to control the new patents, though in direct violation of the speaking phonograph contract of 1878. Meanwhile, the American Graphophone Company ordered 300 graphophones to be made by the Western Electric Company. According to its original incorporation agreement in the state of West Virginia, American Graphophone was to have, quote, the exclusive right to manufacture, use, sell the patented invention known as the graphophone, end quote. The concept of manufacturing was seen as jobbing out to the lowest bidder, and it was thought the finer work, like the fabrication of recorders and reproducers, could be done at the Volta Lab. Toward the sales end, a contract was sought with Thomas R. Lombard, a New York investor, in late 1887. This came to nothing when Lombard's proposal proved too complicated. Hence it was that a man who had made his fortune as the owner of a glass works, who was seeking ways to invest his money, entered the scene. Jesse H. Lippincott had operated the Rochester Tumbler Company near Pittsburgh, PA. He knew Lombard, who was in turn an associate of Edison's. Lippincott had been a member of the syndicate Lombard had formed in his negotiations with American Graphophone, and by early 1888 was familiar with the terms under which that company wished a sales contract to be signed. It was already a point of discussion that the graphophone interests be combined with the Edison Phonograph Company, which had not yet produced a marketable version of the improved phonograph. This was to come in June of 1888, when the so-called improved phonograph was introduced, featuring an incised wax cylinder, though solid wax, and run by an electric motor. Meanwhile, the board of the American Graphophone Company was, in addition to entertaining the proposal of Mr. Lippincott, among others, trying to decide how to approach the production of the instruments themselves. In March, a manufacturing proposition from the Spencer Arms Company was shelved. Despite a lack of a solid production facility, the company, at a special meeting of stockholders held on the 29th of that same month at the Mountain View Hotel in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, overwhelmingly approved a 15-year contract with Lippincott. The notion of combining the graphophone and phonograph interests first suggested in 1885 was now taken up by Mr. Lippincott, who approached Edison and also Gilliland, who had been given an exclusive contract to sell phonographs. In order to achieve his end, Lippincott was forced to buy out the Edison Phonograph Company and Gilliland's sales agency, which had yet to sell a machine. According to the company records, it was Lippincott's agreement with Edison which prevented American Graphophone from suing the inventor for patent infringement in the design of the improved phonograph, most obviously for the appropriation of the incised wax cylinder. Though it was agreed that the two instruments would be marketed equally, Mr. Lippincott began his negotiations with Edison from an aspect clearly prejudiced toward the graphophone. To get it included, Lippincott had to agree to pay American Graphophone a royalty on each phonograph sold. However, this clause would eventually backfire, since the phonograph royalty of $10 per machine was still half of what he was required to pay per graphophone sold. What seemed like monetary affirmation of the graphophone could also be viewed as phonograph price advantage. This point lost on the Graphophone interests in their enthusiasm over the contract, would certainly occur to Lippincott later on. Furthermore, it is clear from the minutes of the officers' meetings in late June of 1888 that the American Graphophone Company had every intention of acquiring the Edison interests in toto, including the old Edison Speaking Phonograph Company, whose only asset was the original phonograph patent. Lippincott had agreed to sell the Edison rights for the same amount he was paying for them to American Graphophone if it should raise the capital. The name of the firm would change to the rather conflicted United Phonograph Graphophone Company, but it never happened. The foregoing nomenclature, that is, phonograph, graphophone, which Mr. Tainter would find very galling, was what the Graphophone Company would use to introduce its product upon the market. Phonograph hyphen graphophone seems less based on a need to bow to Edison's original patent than to endow the unfamiliar graphophone with the public recognition of the phonograph, though it be a recognition of technical rather than practical achievement. It is interesting to note that James H. Saville was alone among the Graphophone officers in objecting to the hyphenated name, fearing it would belittle the Graphophone, and also to the plan of leasing the machines rather than selling them outright. Yes, the instruments were to be leased to the users, but Jesse Lippincott was bound to accept a minimum number of graphophones per year. This would prove a bitter pill. So was born the North American Phonograph Company, with the graphophone in the front seat. It was still too early to see the technical superiority of Edison's machine, and thereby would the graphophone's advantage be lost. The very first 300 graphophones manufactured by Western Electric Company, for which they charged $29.50 each without tables or accessories, were not delivered according to schedule and were not particularly satisfactory to the American Graphophone Company. It set about to solve these production problems, deciding to lease a vacant factory of the Howe Sewing Machine Company in Bridgeport, Connecticut, for a period of 5 years. Mr. Saville and Mr. Tainter were put in charge of the plant, and great hopes were expressed for production and distribution. An October 1888 report to the stockholders suggests the possibility of selling 30,000 a year. Yet, it would soon become clear that whereas neither machine was terribly reliable, the graphophone, with its thinly coated cardboard cylinder of narrow diameter, and its treadle power, was no match for the electric motor phonograph using a better, wider diameter solid wax cylinder. The territorial or local phonograph companies, which had been sold the rights to lease both types of machine across the country, were experiencing great problems with their customers. The graphophones were being returned as unworkable or exchanged for phonographs, though Lippincott was still required to purchase graphophones at a rate of $5,000 per year for the sum of $48.76 each, exclusive of treadle stands. Only one local company seems to have had any success with a graphophone, and that was the Columbia Phonograph Company, which held the Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Delaware territory. Organized in January of 1889, under contract with the North American Phonograph Company, Columbia had as its president an attorney and former newspaper and law stenographer named Edward D. Easton. Although he, like the Graphophone Company officers, had been attracted to the graphophone because of its usefulness in his previous career, Easton was to learn to keep body and soul together by producing vast quantities of cylinder records of the United States Marine Band. while the rest of the local companies, like North American itself, were facing oblivion from poor business and unsatisfactory machines, Columbia spent the time promoting its list of records in the Edison solid wax format. Since the ozocerite-coated graphophone cylinders and the machines that played them were both so unpopular, it was claimed that the nearly 500 selections in the repertoire of the Marine Band had been recorded, that some days brought orders for 1,000 records, and that the band was returning several times each week to record more cylinders. This musical money mill was jealously guarded, and when Edison-related interests took some recordings of the band, suit was brought against them. The value of pre-recorded music had not escaped Mr. Easton. Right from 1885, the graphophone interests had seen the benefit of combining with Edison. Now, in 1890, beset by a world of troubles, the local phonograph companies were clamoring for such a merger. It was hoped one good machine could be created out of two very imperfect ones. Edward Easton approached Edison with his ideas for improving the phonograph, naming 10 points. Samuel Insull of the Phonograph Works called Mr. Easton the most intelligent man in the phonograph business and invited Edison to meet him. There is little here to suggest the nemesis that Columbia would become. Meanwhile, Tainter had collapsed from overwork and resigned his position at the graphophone factory, soon followed by Saville. Easton, now a member of the board of directors of American Graphophone, as well as president of Columbia, embarked on a journey around the country to hear the news from the local companies. The unanimous view was that the phonograph and graphophone should be combined. However, it was already too late. Lippincott was in trouble. He could not hold up under his commitment to accept 5,000 graphophones per annum. Nobody wanted graphophones. A new agreement was drawn up, allowing him to take no more machines than needed as American Graphophone attempted to bolster the failing Lippincott. As of July 1st, 1890, the Bridgeport factory all but shut down, remaining open only to supply parts and make repairs. Company minutes relate that early in 1891, James G. Payne, the president of American Graphophone, traveled to New York City to speak with Jesse Lippincott, who, unfortunately, was in Boston seeking medical treatment. The only man in America authorized to be the primary handler of either type of talking machine was losing his health. At the same meeting where the trip was reported, February 10th, it was resolved to appoint an emergency action committee. The graphophone board heard rumors that Edison was about to buy back the rights to his phonograph. Then Lippincott was forced, on May 2nd, 1891, to assign his estate for the benefit of his creditors. He had defaulted without ever signing the modified graphophone contract. Though North American sputtered on for three more years, the graphophone company had sold its last machine to the firm they had designated their sole licensee. The fate that the American Graphophone Company endured following Mr. Lippincott's estrangement can best be represented in these words drawn from a report by Mr. Easton to the Board of Directors in 1895. From January 1891 until May 1st, 1893, the company endeavored to establish a business by selling graphophones in competition with the phonographs of the North American Phonograph Company. During this period, the total receipts from agents and the public for machines and supplies amounted to about $2,500. He goes on to say that their expenses outstripped income by a rate of 30 to 1. It is fascinating to imagine a skeleton crew with no factory and no prospects piecing together graphophones using treadle machine tops placed in inexpensive oak cases and powered by little 2.5-volt electric motors. Detachable mandrels were made of aluminum, brass, and even felt-covered wood so that Edison-style cylinders could be used on graphophones. Most machines were converted from a feed of 160 threads per inch to the Edison 100 thread per inch design. It appears, however, that some were not. If a machine were to be used strictly for office work, with cylinders recorded and played back on the same or similar machine, it really didn't matter what the feed was. In fact, it would be an advantage to get more lines of dictation on a record by use of the closer threads. Considering the tenuous nature of the graphophone business, I suspect any combination of parts was used to effect a sale. It is not surprising that Mr. Easton identified the bleakest months of the American Graphophone Company as having ended on May 1st, 1893. This was his way of claiming that he saved the company, since on April 10th of that year, he was elected vice president. He had, in fact, shown very solid management skills as president of Columbia, which was doing fine in the record business. His ascendance would, for the first time, bring a local phonograph company and a manufacturer into intimate contact without Mr. Lippincott as a chaperone. Easton took the post of general manager of the American Graphophone Company and 2 years later assumed the presidency from Charles J. Bell in an internal coup when Bell was away in Europe. Finally, he would become general counsel and the unassailable leader of the graphophone interests. However, in 1893, one of the first things Mr. Easton did, as he was about to become vice president and general manager of the Graphophone Company, was to sue himself. Having very limited income prospects, the company sought to exploit the power of the patents they held and manipulate the advantages of the contracts they had already signed. With Lippincott's affairs in complete disarray, Volta and American Graphophone sued the Columbia Phonograph Company as one of the so-called local companies for handling the Edison phonograph, which they claimed to be infringing. You will recall that the American Graphophone Company had contemplated bringing suit against Edison for infringement in 1888, but had demurred when the agreements were signed with North American, thereby giving it a royalty on each phonograph sold. Now it saw no reason not to claim infringement, especially if an important court precedent could be set with an obviously sympathetic defendant. The penniless North American company was forced to represent their contractee, Columbia, which they did with little enthusiasm. Columbia lost the suit in 1894, but won the war, or at least the opening engagement of a long contest with Edison. The validity of the Volta patents over the Edison phonograph had thus been established in the courts, not just contractually, as the old leadership of the graphophone company had tried to do it. The royalty paid to it by Lippincott on each phonograph sold had backfired, hurting the graphophone company, as previously noted. Now it sought to nullify the North American contract and reinforce the idea of the phonograph as an infringing device by citing this royalty. Further eroding Edison's position was the fact that by the letter of the original agreement with Lippincott, he was to have displayed graphophone patent dates on his machines, though he never complied. A nasty legal situation was brewing, and one in which each party had reason to fear the other's patents and resources. It would culminate in a cross-licensing agreement in December of 1896, which would allow both interests to put new machines on the market without fear of injunction. From this point proceeds the new line of spring-motored machines, which will finally gain public acceptance and ensure success for both firms. The fortune of the American Graphophone Company improved stunningly from the time of its practical consolidation with Columbia. It was the tail wagging the dog, but a splendid job of it. My story ends here with the new era of inexpensive spring-motored talking machines playing an ever-burgeoning number of pre-recorded cylinders. From now on, it would be the Columbia that collectors use when they see a graphophone, and soon Washington, D.C. would be left behind. What remains will have to wait until another time. Now, I wish to thank Ray Weil, without whose vast archives and generously shared research, it would have been impossible to create this paper. As I think we all know here, Ray Weil is one of our national treasures. Now, I'm going to stop short of suggesting we have him stuffed while we're down here and put in the Smithsonian. You know, I mean, that's going a bit far, but it couldn't have been done without him. And now we have some slides. Phil, could you do the honors? Please. Okay, this is a very early graphophone from the period where they were just slapping them together as best they could, say around 1892. It's a treadle top that's been divorced from its treadle and put into a very inexpensive oak case with a low voltage motor running it. What you see on it is a Bell Tainter cylinder, and I wanted to show you folks what one of these things looked like. It requires no mandrel to support it like an Edison cylinder does. There are plungers on either side of it which hold it in place. You can see it's quite long compared to a regular Edison cylinder, about the length of a dictaphone or a Ediphone cylinder, but it's very narrow. And the feed was 160 threads to the inch. Now, this machine designated the type U, which they actually sold pretty well because several examples have been seen. If you extrapolate out that $2,500 that Easton claimed was the total amount they took in over a 28-month period, you don't get a lot of graphophones having been sold. But this is 160 threads to the inch. It was never switched over to the Edison 100-thread gearing because, as I mentioned, if it's just being used for dictation, it doesn't have to conform to the Edison scheme because it's not being used for playing pre-recorded cylinders. It plays from right to left, which is different than a regular Edison machine. I'm sure everyone's had some contact with an Edison phonograph. Let's see here. This is the same machine, but with a detachable mandrel in place, and you can see that mandrel, and it's been shortened up a bit with some space on the ends to allow an Edison record to be played on it. And this was very important during that very bleak early 1890s period for the Graphophone Company. They really had to do something to sell these machines. They had a great deal of money invested in them, and when Lippincott defaulted, they had some machines on hand, and then they got a whole bunch of them back. So they really needed to get rid of these things if they could. And that is a brass detachable mandrel. They also made them out of aluminum, and when things were really bad, they even made them out of wood. This is the pulley which contains the information on all early graphophones. Originally, it had Jesse Lippincott's name on it and mentioned the North American Phonograph Company. When this thing was put together in the early 90s, Graphophone had already split off from Lippincott. They just weren't speaking to one another anymore. And it mentions Charles Sumner Tainter, and it mentions the Graphophone Company, but it isn't really, the parts that said Jesse Lippincott and North American have been flattened out. You can see there's a flat spot at the top above the, you know, the American Graphophone Company, and there are some there's a flat spot right at the bottom where they've flattened out information that they didn't want people to know. This is the works outside of a cabinet to another early graphophone from that same period. This one is a Type C graphophone. You can see the motor, and it's just been appended to a treadle top. And again, that has a detachable Edison mandrel, which was pretty important for that period of time. Here's another slightly later graphophone, and this goes into the period after the consolidation of Columbia and American Graphophone, that is the final consolidation with Edward Easton being at the helm of both firms in 1895. This is a Type K. Now, it's been modified even more, and it has a shaver on it, and certain modifications have been made to the frame to allow a shaver to pass across the cylinder. It was strictly 100 thread to the inch Edison type machine and was sold in 1895. Actually, they continued selling it for about a year or so. It's got a graphophone decal on it, which reads Washington, D.C. It's been spruced up a little bit with the decal and a slightly better case. Also, you notice that the nameplate, there's a nameplate on the bed plate or the nickeled bed plate, which doesn't exist on the earlier ones. All the information was always on the pulley. They made this in a spring-motored version as well. This one is electric, but they also made a spring-motored version of the same machine. And here are the last of the treadle-style tops being used. When they made this into a spring-motored version, they changed it even more. And it was one of the first of that new line of phonographs that were allowed to exist because Edison and Columbia finally cross-licensed one another, although this is before that agreement. This is a very dim picture of an Edison Class M, North American Class M, which would have been the chief competitor of the graphophone in the North American company, although they were supposed to have been marketed equally. Of course, the phonograph was a more substantial machine, a more reliable machine, and although it had its problems, it proved to be much more successful. And you can see that even in the fact that the Columbia Phonograph Company was making only pre-recorded Edison cylinders. The other style was not conducive to pre-recorded music. There's a Grenet cell battery that's next to it because it, from the very first, had an electric motor. And although there were treadle versions of it, most of the early Edison machines like this were sold with an electric motor, which again was going to be a little bit better for the operator to use. Here is the Type N graphophone, which was really the first reliable, widely distributed, inexpensive spring-motored graphophone. It hails from that same period of the cross-licensing agreement. It was machines like this. Now, this would have been $40, so it's not cheap, but it's cheaper than what preceded it, and it's getting to be a product which can enjoy wide distribution. It's small, it's easy to use, and it's something that a lot of people can own, unlike the previous machines. This was the beginning of their real popular priced spring motor line. There's a coin-op version of a Type N graphophone that's out of focus. This is really the machine that began the flood of phonographs into the common man's home. This is the Type A graphophone and cost $25. And, you know, again, it cost $25 in 1897. It was a machine which a lot of people could now afford and represented a significant step toward getting phonographs into the hands of everybody. And it was after that, Edison reduced the prices of his machines, introduced new models which were far less expensive than the ones that had preceded them. So this was really the first reasonably priced, reliable talking machine. Just as a kind of a humorous note, you have on the left a Columbia AN graphophone, and on the right a machine called a Thorn Ward, which was also a graphophone that was manufactured for the Montgomery Ward Company. That thing that seems to be growing out of the back of it is actually a horn in back of it. Sure, be glad to. The problem with these pictures is some of the reproducers are not on the machine, so it gets a little rough to see. We can go back to the first one, and you can see the way the reproducer hung on the earliest type. But what's interesting about these two machines is that the one on the left had a Type N motor, which was a better motor, and a Type A top, which was a cheap top, which meant that it would play more records than a Type A. And the one on the right has a Type N top with a Type A motor. And so they exist because one of them existed. So they must both exist. They took the opposite parts from each machine and put them on the other. So you've got a Type A top with a Type N motor and a Type N top with a Type A motor. This is indicative of the graphophone, what they did. Yes, starting with the conversion in the early 90s, what Easton referred to as that 28-month period between January of 91 and May of 93, they began to equip the graphophones to play Edison cylinders. The Edison cylinder being the solid wax one. So after that, all graphophones played solid wax records. They completely abandoned the Zosserite tubes. They just were completely unacceptable to practical use. I can just go back here. You can see the black reproducer hanging there, and that's the way it would be used to play an Edison record. It's real hard to see it, I realize, but it's just hanging just above the mandrel. a slightly different reproducer would have been used to play the Ozasarite records that didn't really, it would never have, the two weren't interchangeable. You couldn't use an Edison reproducer on an Ozasarite record and vice versa, because one had 160 threads to the inch and the other had 100. Any other questions? Well, a lot of experiments were performed in molding, but it wasn't until 1901 that the first molded records were introduced by both Edison and Columbia. Well, not really. You could create a master record whereby you could create others by mechanical duplication or by playing that master record on a machine that was connected acoustically by tubes to a number of others. And when they did record, they recorded using quite a few phonographs. In other words, they'd set up maybe 15 phonographs in a room and they'd get 15 masters that way. Yeah. When they said that the band was coming back, the United States Marine Band was coming back several times a week to record, they were each time probably playing the selections through repeatedly in front of 15 or 20 phonographs, and they were, from that, getting masters that they could use to pantograph or otherwise duplicate many, many other cylinders. But it was a lot of work. A lot of work. Are we all set? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.